Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I'm asking seriously. I mean, you advocate for WIC, and you're absolutely right. Look, I love the fact that WIC is nutritious.
It was a life-saving program.
As a physician, you know, because you've been in the situation, I know as a physician, you're breastfeeding. There are certain things you need to have in your diet.
Right.
Dr. Andy Harris is the chairman of a House subcommittee on ag appropriations with Wisconsin's Gwen Moore.
But I would suggest that as you're growing up, there are certain things you need and certain things you don't need. And now that we know that obesity is caused by, for instance, large sugar intakes, things like that.
Right.
I would just suggest that we're doing the right thing in the WIC program by limiting it to nutritious foods that
right.
that individual needs. I suggest we should consider that for other nutrition programs, and I'll leave it at that.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think food inflation in Canada throughout the pandemic was an issue that truly galvanized Canadians to call for more competition in our economy.
Last week, Federal Trade Commission holding a summit on antitrust and food supply, and Matthew Boswell, Commissioner of the Competition Bureau of Canada.
We saw grocery prices increasing at the fastest rate in 40 years, outpacing inflation in the country. So let me talk about just a couple of things that we have done or are doing. Last year, we engaged in and published in June of 23 a retail grocery market study. That was very timely given the concerns in the Canadian economy about food prices. We came out quite strongly that Canada was in desperate need of more competition in the grocery sector. For a variety of reasons, including high levels of concentration that had been over 30 years increasing, not just in grocery but in the whole food supply chain. We've been looking over the last 5 years very carefully at mergers throughout the food supply chain, and in fact we have one right now between two grain companies that's sort of on our table. We're also working with international partners, people here today, on a supply chain working group. Our cartels team's looking at that. We're continuing an investigation that's been going on for some time into allegations of long-standing price fixing in our bread industry in Canada and on the retail side as well. Last summer, we got a criminal guilty plea in that area from one of Canada's two big bread manufacturers, Baker's, $50 million fine for price fixing over an extensive period of time. And I suppose the last thing, and I know I'm probably burning up too much time, but and it ties to the last panel, which was excellent, is we have tremendous public restraints on competition in the food sector in Canada, in addition to throughout our economy. And we are advocating, we are focusing our efforts tremendously on the advocacy side to tackle the regulatory barriers to competition that we have in Canada. We have interprovincial trade barriers. We have a supply management, agriculture supply management system. So the Bureau is kind of all over the map trying to tackle these food supply chain issues.
Sometimes we joke and say it'll take an act of Congress, but an issue in Canada took an act of Parliament.
Thing was unfolding. People were turning to the Competition Bureau and saying, well, what are you doing? You should be charging them with criminal activity. And we said, whoa, whoa, whoa. 2009, our Parliament amended our price-fixing provisions and took out the word purchase. So we didn't have the ability to bring criminal charges for buy-side. And, I mean, so this motivated our Parliament so much that by 2022, they had, in a very short period of time, kind of record period of time in Canada, they had drafted, put a bill in front of our Parliament, and added in very specific wage-fixing, no-poach provisions because of this whole story related to our grocery sector and the removal of, you know, hero pay for people who legitimately deserved it during the days of the pandemic.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Throughout 2023, the system continued to maintain strong capital and liquidity levels. As of year-end, system capital totaled just over $73 billion, and that was up $4.7 billion, or 6.9% year-over-year.
Brianna Tomlinson is a Supervisory Farm Credit Administration examiner presenting the farm credit system's condition and performance as of year-end at a recent FCA board meeting.
The system's capital to assets ratio was 14.4% at year-end, which was unchanged from a year prior. Regulatory capital levels at all system banks continue to be fundamentally sound. Days of available liquidity for the four funding banks ranged from 161 to 219 days, which was well above the 90-day regulatory minimum. Accumulated other comprehensive loss also declined in 2023 from $4.5 billion compared with $5.5 billion at year-end 2022. And finally, the system continued to have considerable risk-bearing capacity as total capital and the allowance for credit losses equaled 19% of system loans outstanding as of year-end. Overall, composite FERS ratings improved slightly and continue to reflect the system's strong financial condition. Collectively, over 96% of banks and associations have a composite rating of 1 or 2. There were 2 institutions that had a composite rating of 3 or lower, and that was 1 fewer than a year ago. In total, less than 1% of the system assets are held by institutions rated 3 or lower. Looking forward, we anticipate a more challenging operating environment for both borrowers and system institutions. As Rebecca touched on, overall farm sector profitability is projected to be down again in 2024, with net cash farm income forecasted at just under $122 billion, which is down from a record of $202 billion from 2022. Declining commodity prices have resulted in narrowing margins for a number of agricultural sectors, especially cash grains, which we spoke about. Cash grains is also the system's largest commodity segment. We've already seen increased stress in certain industries, including tree nuts, poultry, dairy, and swine. And producers are also facing higher non-feed input costs, including interest expense and labor costs. The net result is increased pressure on profitability, diminished liquidity, and a greater reliance on operating lines, as we discussed earlier. Lower margins and higher interest rates could also have significant implications on farmland values. A couple other concerns that we're keeping an eye on are weather events, which are always a risk for agriculture. And although the drought concerns have subsided somewhat, as Rebecca talked about, initial forecasts point to a very active hurricane season. We're also closely monitoring avian influenza cases and its impact on the egg and poultry segment, as well as its effect and impact on dairy cattle. Continued war in Ukraine and other global tensions are also expected to result in more volatility in input prices and inputs and commodity prices. This more challenging environment is likely to begin to be reflected in system credit quality. Fortunately, system borrowers and institutions have good to strong liquidity and financial positions, which puts them in a good place and provides a degree of risk-bearing capacity to withstand the volatility.
Again, Brianna Tomlinson with the Farm Credit Administration. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Good morning, Chairman Harris, Ranking Member Bishop, members of the subcommittee. I appreciate the opportunity to share updates about an important project to my district and the next generation of United States agriculture.
Nebraska Representative Mike Flood before a House Ag Appropriations Subcommittee.
Specifically, I call your attention to the USDA Ag Research National Center for Resilient and Regenerative Precision Agriculture, the co-located facility at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and the adjacent public-private ag tech accelerator will anchor a national network comprised of ARS and land-grant universities committed to addressing one of the most critical science gaps to advancing innovation in American agriculture. If you live in Iowa, you get enough water that you don't need to irrigate your crops. As you move into the state of Nebraska and you go west, water is a precious, precious resource. States like Colorado, Arizona, California, Texas, They say whiskeys for drinking and waters for fighting. This Precision Agriculture Center will allow us to learn and research how to raise more corn, more grains, more soybeans with less water. And that pays a dividend to every single American and our food security. I want to thank the subcommittee for your past support of this project and in the previous appropriations package. I was extremely pleased to see the subcommittee met the full funding ask and recognize the important need for investments in cutting-edge agriculture. Now we must keep the momentum to secure significant construction funds in FY25 as inflationary escalation costs continue to rise. Congress appropriated $11.2 million for planning and design in FY21, $20 million for construction in FY22, $25 million for construction in FY24. This project has the strong support of our U.S. Senator on the Senate Appropriations Committee, Deb Fischer. I appreciate her leadership there as well. The first phase of construction, slated to begin in the next month, will build 15,000 square feet of greenhouse and 10,000 square feet of headhouse space and connect with the existing Greenhouse Innovation Center. The second phase of construction, which will commence when Congress appropriates all the funds, will go toward constructing a 120,000 square foot, four-story laboratory and office building on the Nebraska Innovation Campus. ARS will utilize these facilities for scientists and staff in the two existing research units in conjunction with the two new research units. Ultimately, USDA expects to double its science and support staff presence in Lincoln at this new complex. Precision ag is a key piece of Nebraska's agricultural fabric, but by extension, the rest of America, and it makes sense that this is located in the Cornhusker State. A January 2024 GAO report showed Nebraska is at the forefront of utilization and adoption of precision ag technology and practices. To give you a little background, you may not know this, but the Ogallala Aquifer is the largest freshwater underground ocean that sits under the state of Nebraska into Kansas, into Colorado, and a portion of Wyoming. We have the most of it. And since 1955, using science and what we call natural resource districts, we have protected that water resource to the tune of we've only lost a foot since 1995 of this underground water aquifer. We believe in precision and regenerative agriculture. We want to learn how to raise even more corn with less water and teach the rest of the world how to do the same. We want states like Colorado, where they're begging for water. The city of Denver wants to take water out of the South South Platte and divert it to Denver just to meet the growing number of folks that need it. This will allow us as Nebraskans to do more with less. Same thing for rural Wyoming, same thing for rural Colorado and across the western states. This is the kind of synergy between government, universities, industries, small businesses that will benefit USDA, Nebraska, and a nation's ag economy and producers across the nation.
Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This is not the first time we have faced serious questions of monopsony power in agriculture markets and market power on the sell side.
Michael Cadis is Deputy Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice's Antitrust Division.
Way back at the end of the 19th century, the U.S. government tried to enforce Sherman Act violations against the major meat processors. At the time, the five largest meat processors accounted for 80% of all meat processed in the United States. By the way, today it's four account for 85%. And one of the things they were struggling with was courts seemed very skeptical to the issue. I know that's something none of us as antitrust enforcers have any experience with. So what happened? Well, it's one of the reasons why the government created the Federal Trade Commission. The first report the Federal Trade Commission did, massive three-volume juggernaut, was on meatpacking. The same day they filed that report, the Department of Justice filed a critical consent decree, had the impact of helping to deconcentrate the industry. But Congress wasn't even done then. In 1921, and for those of you who know your history, right, not the most progressive liberal Congress ever to sit in the United States Congress. Nevertheless, they passed this law, the Packers and Stockyards Act. And if you look at the Packers and Stockyards Act, what you see, and you think about the time, is like somebody sat down and looked at every bad antitrust decision and tried to write around it. That's what we did. The resulting interrelationship of all those forces and cooperation across the government was incredibly successful. By the 1970s, those five meat packers controlled, it was either 20 or 30% of the market. So we know what the solution is, and it requires a whole of government approach. What just sort of thinking through what the cases the Department of Justice has brought, I'm going to quickly summarize them, but I want to stress two things. One, think about who we're working with, and think about what part of the food chain we are actually addressing. So one of the major issues that farmers face is right to repair. You have only, it's a very concentrated industry, and the equipment manufacturers make it much harder for them to fix their equipment. So like for a farmer, fixing their equipment is exactly the one thing they have always done. They brought a private suit to challenge that policy. The Department of Justice weighed in with an amicus brief. Recently, the Seventh Circuit agreed with and reversed the dismissal. And I will have to say, in my entire life of speaking, I never got an applause line like I got for just saying the Department of Justice filed a brief agreeing with farmers on right to repair when I was speaking at the National Farmers Union. We have cases alleging that workers in the poultry processing plants had reduced wages because of an information sharing exchange that was going on for 20 years. We also have the case which we're doing with the state of Minnesota.
You guys in AgriStats?
No. Okay. Sorry. that information that my colleague talked about, we have brought not one, but two cases under the Packers and Stockyards Act. The second one involved these chicken growers who, very weak bargaining position, faced the processor who said, oh, you know, on top of every other way we control the market, we'll actually penalize you if you take a competitive offer and leave. And then finally, and so that was really critical for the USDA. And finally, last week, Dole and Fresh Express not only announced they're abandoning their merger, but they really nicely blamed the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division. And you know, we will take that blame any day of the week.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
HPAI, or highly pathogenic avian influenza, is detected in dairy cattle in multiple states, starting with Texas.
At a recent Farm Credit Administration board meeting, Rebecca Kaiser, economist with FCA.
This is the first U.S. case of transmission from wild birds into cattle. So far, the virus seems to have a low fatality rate in cattle and is causing a decrease in milk output, but the cattle seem to recover. Right now, there's no worry about the spread of the virus from milk products to humans, as no milk from sick cows ever enters the milk supply, and milk that is in the milk supply or on shelves, you know, is pasteurized before hitting shelves. However, there has been one case of a producer contracting the virus from cattle. He was a dairy cattle worker. He seems to be recovering well. So not much worry about humans catching it from other mammals. Now, we're also seeing the spread of this virus into egg-laying flocks in Texas and now in Michigan. So far, the cases, number of cases in 2022 and 2023, when the virus was at its peak, were much higher than what we're seeing right now. Also, as the warmer months come around and spring migration of wild flocks decreases, we're likely to see a decrease in these cases and not have it turn out to be a huge outbreak as in past years. The talk of hogs and pigs lately has been California's Proposition 12, which sets out minimum space requirements for sows. Any pork that is marketed in California must come from compliant sows or must be born of compliant sows. It was passed by voter approval in 2018, but with different court cases and appeals that led to the Supreme Court, it was delayed in implementation. So with the Supreme Court's decision, the law was allowed to stand and took effect July 1st, 2023, with the first 6 months being a sort of a grace period for producers. As of January 1st, 2024, the full law is in enforcement. Hog margins have been narrow at the same time that this Proposition 12 has been in place and in working, with frequently negative returns for farrow to finish operations. 14 out of the last 16 months have been negative, with negative $49 happening back in April of 2023. Currently, that number stands at about negative $18. With these low margins, farrowings are decreasing, but pigs per litter is increasing, which is having an offsetting behavior for the reductions in the breeding herd. With that offsetting behavior, pork production is staying high amid these low returns. Now, good news for hog producers is prices have been on an upward trend since the start of the year, catching up to five-year averages. However, prices are likely to remain volatile throughout the year as producers face high slaughter rates, as well as regulations that are affecting their production practices, such as Prop 12. Proposition 12 is set to add costs to producers in a couple of different ways. Producers that would like to market their pork to California markets have to be compliant whether or not they are in California. So to do that, they have two options, really. One is to decrease the number of sows they have and in that way give each animal the minimum space requirements. The second option is they can expand their facilities and keep the number of sows the same to give each animal their minimum space requirements. Either option is going to be very costly for these producers, especially now with high interest rates. Costs will also be felt down the supply chain, trying to keep pigs, compliant pigs and compliant pork separate during the transportation and slaughtering process, as well as labeling all different compliant and non-compliant products. It was believed that the staggered implementation of this law would maybe mitigate some of the effects of the Proposition 12. However, California consumers are already seeing higher prices. One study came out that showed, on average, they're seeing 20% increases in prices for cuts of pork that are covered under the proposition compared to the rest of the United States that is not seeing those same price increases. Boneless pork loins are having the greatest increase in price at 41%.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I grew up hungry.
Representative Gwen Moore from Wisconsin testifying recently before a House subcommittee on ag appropriations.
I often went without breakfast or lunch and would find myself eating leftovers off my friends' plates at lunchtime to get through the day. My experience is not unique. According to the Department of Agriculture, over 30 million households with children are food insecure. WIC is the nation's premier and proven prevented public health nutrition program. And by law, WIC is designed to supplement diets and provide nutrients for healthy growth and development. It currently supports over 6 million low-income and nutritionally at-risk mothers and young children by providing nutritious foods, education on healthy eating, and referrals to health care and related services. WIC participants experience reduced rates of childhood obesity, increased dietary quality and variety, higher immunization rates, and higher cognitive development scores. Participants also benefit from breastfeeding education and support led by breastfeeding peer counselors who are often members of the programs themselves. The WICS program evidence-based food packages are available to participants according to their life stage and nutritional needs. These food packages must be regularly updated to align with the latest science. And I'm going to get off script for a minute, hoping that my time will permit me to do it. And I remember when my daughter had her first pregnancy and gave birth to a 1 pound, 2 ounce baby and needed to breastfeed. And that was so expensive because what she needed was not milk and cheese. She needed fresh fruits and vegetables and good protein. And I mean, it cost me an arm and a leg to feed her. That 1 pound, 2 ounce baby now has a bachelor's degree in finance, and the banks and everybody fighting over her want to pay her tuition so she can get her CPA. But she was 1 pound, 2 ounces at birth, and WIC would have been very important to her. The formulary hadn't changed enough to accommodate the need for her to get fresh fruits and vegetables. That came out of my pocket. I had to get the whole village involved in buying the fresh fruits that she needed. That's my experience. Just this week, the most recent updates to those food packages were finalized. It is critical that we let science, not politics, like needing whole milk. No, you don't need whole milk to continue to guide the food packages. My daughter needed broccoli, not whole milk. One highlight of this update is the change to encourage participants to eat more fruits and vegetables by increasing the cash value CVB amounts. In fiscal year 2024, this benefit was targeted for cuts in this subcommittee. And I hope that this year the subcommittee will fully fund this science-based recommendation. On top of health benefits, WIC serves as a key economic driver, providing benefits to taxpayer and local communities. When a family makes a WIC purchases, it infuses cash into local communities and small businesses, strengthening local economies all over the country. And yes, Mr. Bishop, supporting our farmers. Now more than ever, it's necessary to strengthen our investment in WIC as we are now seeing enrollment steadily increasing. Until we have a hunger-free America, Mr. Chairman, we will need a strong WIC.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The government's Consumer Price Index report for March is getting a lot of serious attention right now because it shows an unexpectedly high rate of annual inflation, 3.5%, in the general economy. However, experts say you can't blame that on food prices. In fact,
food at home or grocery prices were actually flat in March.
No increase at all. This from Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer. She says that during March, of the 15 major food categories she tracks, prices went up for 9, down for 6.
For the most part, we saw prices increase for categories across the meats, poultry, and fish categories. Prices declined for dairy products, for fats and oils, sugar and sweets, cereals and bakery products, and for fresh fruits and fresh vegetables.
Leading overall grocery store food prices up from this time a year ago, but by only 1.2%. Oh, Schweitzer says some foods are selling for less than a year ago, namely eggs, dairy products, fish, and seafood. Gary Crawford, Washington.